Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
It is the final episode of July here on Legal Face Off. WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here. Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. Ben Anderson behind the glass. We'll talk about the merger of John Marshall Law School with one of the colleges in Chicagoland, a new president at the Federal Bar Association, plus a new app that helps develop business for lawyers. But we start with one of our favorite guests here on LFO, one of the most famous attorneys in American law, professor emeritus at Harvard Law, and an author, new book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, available now on Amazon. Professor Alan Dershowitz with us on Legal Faceoff.
Professor, in addition to being one of the foremost legal experts in the world, and professor emeritus at Harvard, among your many other accolades, you're an author. The latest book, as Sam mentioned, is The Case Against Impeaching Trump, which you've talked about is not going to make you popular among your neighbors at Martha's Vineyard. Are you calling from there?
Well, I am calling from Martha's Vineyard. I'm not going to let them vote me off the island, although I think if there were a vote, they would vote me off the island. They would be building a statue to me if Hillary Clinton had been elected president and the Republicans were yelling lock her up and trying to impeach her, and I were making exactly the same arguments I make in my book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump. They would be so happy with what I'm saying. But because I'm saying it about Trump, they're furious. They just don't understand the concept of defending someone's civil liberties. In fact, to make the point, my publisher published a mock cover entitled The Case Against Impeaching Hillary Clinton, just to make the point that I would be making exactly the same arguments if Hillary Clinton had been elected. I wish she had been elected. I worked very hard for her election, as I'm working hard for the election of Democratic candidates in the Senate and the Congress.
So, Professor, why don't you tell us a bit about your book? There's been some commentary about the format being a little bit different than your traditional book. It starts with an essay, then it goes into transcripts from some of your recent interviews, as well as a few of your op-ed pieces. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure. It was Memorial Day, which is only a month and a half ago. I was sitting on the porch of the Chilmark store in Martha's Vineyard, and a guy who's friends with a publisher said, you know, you want to write a book about impeachment because a lot of people are calling for impeachment. And he said, I have a publisher who can get this book out very quickly. So I made the agreement on Memorial Day. By June 17th, I had finished the book. And by June 27th, I had a hard copy of it in my hands. And by, like, July 15th, it was a New York Times bestseller. So it's amazing how quickly today you can get a book from your head onto the bestseller list. And in order to do it that quickly, obviously, I had to write a new introduction that is a 30-page analysis of the case against impeachment. And then I used my columns and my appearances on TV, mostly my columns, to lay out the specifics of why, although I disagree with this president fundamentally regarding his policies, I don't think he has committed an impeachable offense or a prosecutable crime.
All right, so why is that? Break that down for our listeners. Why has what Trump has either done or been accused of not risen to the level of an impeachable offense?
Well, I've done the research, and I've come to the conclusion that the framers of the Constitution rejected the British approach, which was to impeach people for maladministration of office, basically if they do a terrible job. They rejected that and instead put in very, very daunting criteria for impeachment: treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, conviction after a trial by the Senate by a two-thirds vote. They wanted to make impeachment very, very difficult. And I look back at the record and the history and conclude that for a president to be impeached, he actually has to commit and be tried for a specific crime, either a federal crime or a state crime, and it has to be a high crime, a crime that affects governance. It can't be what President Clinton was impeached for, and that is a low crime, alleged perjury about a tawdry sex affair in the Oval Office. And I lay out all the legal arguments. I would make the same arguments had Hillary Clinton been elected, and they were saying that Benghazi is a grounds for impeachment, or destroying her emails is a grounds for impeachment. I would have made the same arguments because that's what I honestly believe. And the difference is I would have enjoined by a lot of liberals and Democrats in making that argument, the same liberals and Democrats, I'm a liberal too, but the same Democrats who reject my legal reasoning would accept it with open arms if it benefited Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump.
So you've mentioned that you're being shunned on Martha's Vineyard, and that's actually where you're joining us from right now. How is life these days since the book came out a couple weeks ago?
It's fine, except nobody wants to engage with me. Very few. I did have an open forum on Martha's Vineyard, and people from around the island, mostly not from Chilmark, which is the liberal enclave, came to hear me, and I think many came away persuaded that I made a strong argument. You can disagree with the argument, but the idea of not engaging or not talking to me or telling people, I mean, what one professor from MIT has been going around telling everybody, please don't ever talk to me, and please don't invite me anywhere, and if you do, he won't show up. So he's been kind of leading the campaign. And what I equated that to is what I grew up with. When I grew up, there were bold lawyers, brave lawyers who defended communists. And those lawyers, who were not themselves communists, they were anti-communists, were shunned and were subject to the kind of thing that I'm being subject to. And it's wrong because it associates the person who I'm speaking on behalf of with something I agree with. I mean, I don't agree with Donald Trump's policies, but I disagree with going after him on improper grounds. And that's what happened with communism. When I was a kid in college, I defended the rights of communists to speak. And the president of the university refused to recommend me to law school because he said I was a communist sympathizer. So I've been through this before. I'm going to be through it again. That's the way I live my life. I defend unpopular people, unpopular causes, because I'm a true civil libertarian, unlike the ACLU, which has abandoned its priorities for free speech and due process and instead has accepted $130 million in contributions just to go after President Trump on political grounds.
Professor, the Kavanaugh hearing starts soon for the vacant Supreme Court seat. You're obviously a close watcher of the Supreme Court. You're a former clerk for Justice Goldberg of the Supreme Court. There's lots of talk about whether Kavanaugh would be able to impartially decide the issue of whether Trump can be subpoenaed, whether he is subject to impeachment, all issues involving Trump. Where do you stand on those issues?
Well, we have some history there. Obviously, the justices who Nixon appointed voted against him when the subpoena issue came up, and the justices that Clinton appointed voted against him when the Paula Jones came up. So I think justices are fully capable of voting against presidents who appoint them. Look, I wouldn't have appointed Kavanaugh. I would have appointed Merrick Garland. I think he was the one who should be on the Supreme Court, and I think the Republicans stole that nomination from President Obama. But Kavanaugh will almost certainly get through because he has a superb record as a litigator, as a professor, as a judge, as a serious intellectual. He will probably render decisions that I fundamentally disagree with, but that's not the basis on which you nominate, accept, or reject a Supreme Court justice. I think of what President Hoover did when he appointed Justice Cardozo to the Supreme Court, who was a liberal Democrat and a Jew, and it was a very, very unpopular choice, but he said, I'm going to fill this vacancy with the most qualified judge who can fill the seat of Oliver Wendell Holmes. His attorney general gave him a list of 10 names. Cardozo was on the bottom, and Hoover turned over the list and said, it's a great list, but you have it upside down, and he appointed Cardozo. Those days are gone forever, where you appoint the most qualified people to the Supreme Court. Today, you appoint people who you think will serve your partisan agenda on both sides.
Professor, last question on Legal Face-Off. In addition to being one of the foremost legal experts in the world, you're a sports fan, prominently a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. You were 9 years old when the Dodgers won the 1947 National League Championship, and very famously, you own a ring.
I do, yeah. I'm wearing my T-shirt right now, which says Brooklyn Against the World, second annual baseball series, August 15th, 1950s, the mid-50s, when I was a great Brooklyn Dodger fan. The Brooklyn Dodgers finally won the World Series in 1955, and it was a cause for great celebration. But now, of course, My heart is with the Boston Red Sox, who have the best record in the major league. So I'm pretty happy about what's going on in baseball
these
days.
We might see a Red Sox-Dodgers World Series. I'm curious on that point. We've got Hall of Fame ceremonies coming up here in the next couple of weeks, both football and baseball. And, you know, we've seen Terrell Owens, who is upset and who's not going to the induction ceremony because he was kept out for a couple of years. Where do you stand on the idea of baseball players and athletes in general being kept out of the Hall of Fame, people like Pete Rose, because of off-the-field issues instead of simply judging them on their on-field actions?
Well, I think it's wrong to judge them on off-the-field activities. Pete Rose is a closer case because, you know, managers also make it to the Hall of Fame and owners, and the allegations against him relate to when he was a manager. On balance, I would put him in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, if you start looking at off-field behavior, you have to start asking about Ty Cobb and Babe Ruth and some of the great Giants who had just horrendous private lives and private attitudes and views. I think you stick to athletic prowess when you're picking people for the highest accolade in sports achievement. So I think Pete Rose belongs in the Hall of Fame.
The book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, another blockbuster by Alan Dershowitz, available on Amazon and everywhere you buy books. Alan Dershowitz, thank you again for joining us on WGN. Please come back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bye.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Joining us now on the phones on Legal Face Off, she is the president of the Board of Trustees at John Marshall Law School, and JMLS has merged with UIC. Paula Hudson-Holderman joining us now on Legal Face Off. Good morning, Paula.
Paula, thanks so much for joining us today. You are the president of the Board of Trustees of the John Marshall Law School, and the news broke last week that the University of Illinois Board of Trustees approved the merger of UIC with John Marshall Law School. And so we are now one step closer to seeing a combined school.
The law school.
Right, exactly. And I'm a proud UIC alum, by the way, of the engineering school from the early 1990s. Thank you. Can you share with our listeners the reasons for this combination and what additional steps need to happen before it becomes final?
Well, so there are, of course, reasons that the UIC wanted to merge, and there are reasons that John Marshall wanted to merge. So UIC basically wanted to have a law school and also wanted to have a law school in terms of, you know, offering some synergies with other departments like their medical, their dental, urban planning. Healthcare has become a huge issue, both, you know, in the legal world especially, and so having a medical school now combined or having access to a law school is going to be very helpful to them. UIC is one of the only major research universities in the country that doesn't have a law school, and so again they wanted to round that out. And interestingly, the city of Chicago is really the only big city in the United States where there was not a public law school. So all of those reasons for UIC were kind of the moving forces for them. In terms of John Marshall, we had sort of different reasons. So we've been around. We were founded in 1899. We're an independent law school. And it has become challenging for independent law schools in this market to have the same kind of energy and resources that some of the public schools have. And so we just started, the Board of Trustees started looking forward and saying, okay, where are we going to be in 10 years, 30 years, et cetera? We're financially in good shape right now, but, you know, we're, like I said, we had an obligation, I think, to look forward and decided now would be a great time to find a partner. And frankly, UIC is going to be an incredible partner for us.
Paula, why is a public law school important? And in general, why is public interest law something that law schools should focus on?
Having a public law school, for one thing, it changes the tuition structure. So currently the tuition for a year at John Marshall is about $48,000. When it becomes a public law school, it will be much more in line with public tuition. That'll be up to the U of I Board of Trustees to set. But if you look at, other graduate departments, you're probably looking at around, $36,000. So that's a $12,000 savings. You multiply that times three, that's $36,000. That's a huge chunk in a student's student debt and what they owe back. And I'm sure you know from being a legal analyst, law student debt is one of the things that is just crushing the legal market right now, as kids are getting out with anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000 in debt. So one advantage is we'll be reducing the student load, the student debt load. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of the, why is public interest law so important? So public interest law, and not that that's all that, John Marshall would be doing, but certainly public interest law is essential. And for a city like Chicago, we've got to have, law students and lawyers who are willing to work in the public sector, be it government or, legal aid. And frankly, those jobs don't pay much, for obvious reasons, which, again, gets back into the circle of why it's so important to reduce the student debt load so folks can take these jobs that don't pay as much as, law firm kinds of positions. And right now, John Marshall has 9 clinics. Probably some of the best known would be our Fair Housing Clinic, where we've handled some of the most important cases in the city of Chicago, for some 50 years, involving, racial discrimination, gender orientation discrimination. And so those are very important in terms of the public sector. We also have a veterans clinic, and I'm sure you can understand how important that is. Folks returning, from service and the various issues that they are facing, some of them legal, but often, they're social kind of combined with legal, which is, I think, another one of the areas where UIC and John Marshall together are going to be able to make a huge difference and a much more sort of holistic impact for folks like veterans.
That's Paula Hudson Holderman. She is president of the Board of Trustees of the John Marshall Law School. Paula, we'll be watching this story as it evolves. Please come back and discuss its progress.
Love to. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you.
You can follow Legal Face Off on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. And you can always find us on iTunes. Search for Legal Face Off. Rate, review, and listen to the show. Joining us now on the phones, Maria Vathis, newly elected president of the Federal Bar Association, about the issues ahead in her upcoming presidency.
Maria, you are president-elect of the Federal Bar Association. You will be installed this upcoming September with an effective date of October 1. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on the show.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the Federal Bar Association and what its mission is?
Sure. So the Federal Bar Association is a national bar association serving federal practitioners and also the federal judiciary. And it's a wonderful organization. We do a lot of good in the community, which I think is the best part about it.
So talk to us about some of that, some of those activities. I know that the National Civics Initiative and Resources for Civics Education as part of the FBA, the Wills for Veterans program, among others. Could you talk to us about some of the initiatives that you currently are involved with and what you hope to further as president of the Federal Bar Association?
Absolutely. So the organization has been in wonderful hands, which makes my job quite easy. So we have been doing a national community outreach project for several years now, and it's a nationwide initiative for our chapters to work with their local courts in order to make an impact in the communities across the nation. And we certainly do that here in Chicago. Our federal bench at the Northern District Court is very supportive, and we do a program in April where we bring students from a school, you know, disadvantaged school in Chicago to the courthouse, and the judges put on a mock trial or a mock hearing. The students have the ability to ask questions, talk to attorneys, talk to judges, and then we provide a lunch as well. That's always a rewarding program and just very heartwarming. We also have, as you mentioned before, a civics education program as well. So our website, www.fedbar.org, has resources like educational materials, programs, and videos for students of all ages. We also do a civics essay contest. We've done that for 2 years. This past year, we partnered with the Federal Judges Association, which was great. And we have a different topic. Our first topic was, what does an impartial judicial system mean to you? We're going to do a contest again this year as well, and we provide cash prizes. Last year, we did both a written component with an essay and also a video component. So stay tuned to see what opportunities we have coming this year. But I highly recommend and encourage people of high school age in the Chicago area to participate.
The FBA also assists veterans. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Wills for Veterans program?
Yes. So some of our chapters have a Wills for Veterans program, and it's really been a rewarding initiative. And what they do is essentially it's a pro bono project, and federal bar chapters provide services like drafting and signing services to any veterans in their local area. We tend to do this program in November to coincide with Veterans Day, although some of the chapters do it at a different time that's, you know, convenient for them. So that's another program that we're very proud of and that will continue this year as well.
Maria, I imagine Judge Amy Coney Barrett is a member of the Chicago chapter. You almost had some news with her recently.
Absolutely. I don't want to get into anything political, but absolutely, yes. I'm sure it's been quite exciting for her.
Yeah, it would have been very interesting to see someone local go to the Supreme Court. Obviously, very, you know, incredibly qualified jurist and member of your organization. What other outreach efforts do you hope to make in the community and to engage people who maybe haven't had much association with the law or with the court system as president of the FBA?
Well, we're also going to do a nationwide fitness challenge for our members too, and also health and wellness awareness. And that, I think, applies to everybody in some way. So we will have resources on our website for that as well. You know, we're going to just try to encourage people to be mindful of taking care of themselves. And, you know, everybody's got a demanding schedule, but it's very important to make time for, you know, health, wellness, fitness, proper nutrition, things like that as well. So that's something that I'm really excited about doing this year.
Maria Vathis of counsel at Bryan Cave, also the president-elect of the Federal Bar Association. The website is fedbar.org. Thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
Thank you.
Our final guest on Legal Face-Off this week, Lauren Glennon, Glennon Law LLC, the founder of LawCo App, which develops business for lawyers. Lauren, welcome to LFO.
Lauren, so explain to us exactly what LawCo is.
Sure. First of all, good morning. Thanks for having me on. LawCo is a legal app. It's newly developed. It's free for download in both the Google Play and Apple stores. And what it does is that it gives access, legal access, to people that normally wouldn't have it. And it also lets attorneys pick up leads instantaneously in real time. So let's say a consumer was on their way to the courthouse. It would help match that consumer with an attorney that was already there.
That's great. So what made you decide to launch this? It seems like maybe it's more of a real-time sort of functionality than some other websites and other applications that similarly match lawyers with people in need of lawyers.
Sure. So I was actually at the Markham. I'm an attorney myself. So I was actually at the Markham Courthouse, and I was helping a friend with a traffic ticket, and I was looking around, and there were so many people, and they were all on their phone. And a lot of them look lost and kind of confused, right? Like, do I need an attorney? Should I be here with a lawyer? Things like that. And, you know, people for the most part would say, like, why would you ever go to court without a lawyer? But you'd be surprised at so many people that don't have access, don't know where to turn or where to start. And some of those other legal matching systems, you know, they're leads that attorneys maybe don't see or don't want, or, you know, or can't actually jump on the lead if it's just right now. But if you're an attorney and you have the app on your phone and you're already at the courthouse, why wouldn't you jump on that lead? So that's kind of where it started.
It's like a dating app for lawyers. I'm sure you've heard that many times, right?
I mean, seemingly so, right?
Yeah.
So sorry, just quickly, we just started marketing about 4 to 6 weeks ago just to attorneys. And as you know, being an attorney yourself there, Rich, it's tough. It's a tough market. So we've done a great job just kind of getting, you know, in with the bar associations and things like that. And we've had 50 attorneys sign up, and we've already had people matching with, you know, potential clients. And we have a few success stories. So it's been really great so far.
So tell me about how a potential client will find a lawyer that is an expert. You know, we can't really use the term expert so much for lawyers, but that specializes in what they do. Is there a filtering system, I imagine, so that if you're in the Markham Courthouse, for example, and you're looking for someone to represent you in a traffic ticket, you don't hire a divorce lawyer?
Correct. So what happens is it's all user-based. So that's how we were able to get around any of the solicitation problems. So the user actually reaches out to the attorney. And how that happens is it's geographical location. So we have, if you need an attorney for a court case, we pick your courthouse, and then pick your court case type. So, right. So they're like, I'm at Markham. I need a traffic attorney. And then they can also kind of plug in a little bit of a narrative if they'd like about what's happening with the case. And then they also pick a time and a date. So it gives them all of those drop-down options on the first screen. So really it's like three clicks to connect to an attorney, which is wonderful. So then that kind of goes into the app, and then the attorney has the attorney side of it, which we verify every attorney with the ARDC. We're trying to work with them for like a data dump to make sure that we're updated, but right now we're just doing it manually. So we're verifying and vetting that attorneys are who that they say they are, and the way that we do that is by their registration page, they have to take a picture of their ARDC card, which we then see, and then match that with the ARDC records to make sure that there's no disciplinary proceedings, making sure that they are active to practice. And then they pick up the lead. So the attorney buys the lead, basically. They pay for it. We have promo codes. Right now, it's $40 for them to pick up a lead. And then they match with the, you know, potential client. And then they can message within the app once they've paid the lead with that potential client and say, hey, I can meet you at courtroom 206. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Or I'm wearing, you know, a black suit. This is, you know, I'll see you there. And then, which is neat, is once the attorney closes the case, both messages, the transcripts, are emailed to both the attorney and to the user. So there's no he said, she said on the messaging part. So we were trying to cover our bases with that. So there's no, you know, guarantees of success that were given or potentially given, you know, as attorneys cannot do. So if there's any dispute, it's all transcribed and emailed to both parties.
So it sounds like you actually, when attorneys sign up, that they will pay a fee for a lead. What other aspects of the business model are there? For example, do attorneys who sign up, do they have to pay a fee up front as well?
Nope. No. So it's literally just a free download. And then once you're on the app, you can kind of, you know, maneuver through it as the attorney and say like, oh, this, you know, traffic ticket works for me because it's in Bridgeview, but you know, what if a traffic ticket comes up in, you know, Skokie and you don't want that, right? So you don't commit to anything until you're actually in and on the app itself, which is great. So there's no commitment whatsoever.
Laura Glennon, an attorney, actually managing member of Glennon Law LLC and the founder of Law Co. For more information, it's so new that this website is just developing, but it'll be getlawco.com. And Laura, Lauren, thanks for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you both so much for your time. I enjoyed it.
We end the show the way we always do on Legal Faceoff. Time for the Legal Grab Bag. Rich and Tina have seven topics.
Starting off Legal Grab Bag this morning, Tina, we all saw the tragedy in Branson involving the duck boat that sank. I think it was 17 people that lost their lives. From a legal perspective, it would seem at first glance that this would be a slam dunk lawsuit against the operator of the duck boat for damages. I know you're an expert in admiralty law. There's actually an old maritime law that might limit liability for the operator. It's a 167-year-old law that basically shields the operators of boats from liability in these circumstances, if it applies. The question is whether it'll apply, but the act is called the Shipowners Limitation of Liability Act from 1851. And as I mentioned, it frequently will cap damages to no more money than the salvage value of the sunken vessel. It also allows ship owners to file limitation proceedings, which can consolidate plaintiffs' claims resulting from a boat disaster into just one federal court case. You frequently see these kind of federal statutes. And another example is the MGM lawsuit that's getting a lot of attention, where they are suing victims of the Vegas shooting. They're trying to bring it into federal court, trying to limit liability. And in this case, in the duck boat case, the reason for this law is because back in the 1850s, there weren't a lot of big boats. And the idea was, if you are going to engage in maritime commerce and invest in a boat, we're going to give you a break by shielding you from liability. They didn't obviously envision this kind of accident. So, you know, they might be able to pursue a state court action, but this act might limit their liability and cap damages in federal court.
So what do you think is the likelihood that this type of law will end up getting amended or stricken at some point?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, these old laws are usually ones that are hard to overturn. But, you know, I think a crafty personal injury lawyer will be able to get around. I mean, there's another duck boat incident. The most recent one was in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And I think the average recovery was $2 million for each member of the estate in that case. So there are ways around it. We'll see if the ultimate lawsuit survives. Next story involves an alderman who's also a lawyer here in Chicago that's been in the news.
Yeah, last week a federal judge set trial for former Chicago alderman Edward Doliak for tax day of all days next year. And this relates to tax charges arising from a huge settlement that the state of Illinois had reached with tobacco companies back in the 1990s. Verdoliak has pleaded not guilty to charges that were filed against him back in 2016, claiming that he obstructed an IRS investigation into this tobacco settlement that was struck with the state by hiding payments to and from a friend and co-defendant, Daniel Soso. Prosecutors claim that Soso and Verdoliak received more than $10 million in fees from that settlement, even though they weren't authorized to perform any legal work on behalf of the state and did no such work. The settlement had originally sparked controversy when it was revealed that Jim Ryan, who was then the Illinois Attorney General, had negotiated a contingency arrangement, which resulted in nearly $190 million being promised to four different law firms that handled the litigation. Prosecutors claim that Ryan actually didn't know that the defendants were getting a cut, and that if he did, he would have taken steps to recover those payments. Verdoliak's lawyers claim that his cut was actually approved by Ryan and others who were involved in the settlement. Verdoliak is seeking dismissal of the charges on the grounds that there was a 20-year delay in bringing the indictment, and that there are a number of witnesses that he would have wanted to call in his defense, but they've either died or are otherwise unable to come to his defense.
Verdoliak is a sort of a dinosaur in many ways. He harkens back to the city council wars back in the 70s and 80s. City council here in Chicago used to be a very combative place. It's not so much anymore, especially under Rahm Emanuel. But I've got a good Verdoliak story. I have cases against Verdoliak right now, and I was at a deposition in his office on the south side probably 5 or so years ago, and the deposition was actually held in Verdoliak's office. And he's got, you know, as an older lawyer, politician, obviously he's got, you know, big office, and the walls are surrounded by pictures of him with every elected official for the last 50 years. I mean, there's Reagan, there's Supreme Court justices, et cetera. And we held the deposition, even though he was not on the case, in Ed Verdoliak Sr.'s office. And you sit there, and it's, you know, like I mentioned, pictures all over the wall, and there's a big portrait of Verdoliak on the wall, kind of the kind you would see like in a castle
in
somewhere.
In his office? That's interesting.
So the whole time I'm doing the deposition, I'm, you know, behind me is this big portrait of Verdoliak, and I'm sure, I swear the eyes were moving at different points. I swear I could see the eyes moving at different points during the deposition, but...
Did you call him Sir Verdoliak?
Well, he wasn't doing the deposition, but his image was all over us. All right, moving on to a Kardashian story. Kardashian's always in the news and always helping us out with legal content here on the Face Off.
Yes, there's always a Kardashian story to keep us entertained. So
this one involving trademark infringement, which, if we haven't said, Tina Martini is the intellectual property attorney at McDermott, Will & Emery.
So, yes, it's interesting how there seems to be a plethora of these trademark stories these days. So in the latest trademark infringement story, Kim Kardashian's company, KKW Beauty, was sued a few days ago by a company called Vibes Media. And the claims arise over a new fragrance that is one of three that Kardashian's company just recently launched about a week ago. And it's called Vibes. It is in a bottle that is shaped as a speech bubble. And Vibes Media claims that her packaging and her logo infringes its logo, which is likewise a speech bubble with the word Vibes in it. They claim that it is a copy of their trademarked company logo, and it is likely to cause confusion with their branding. Vibes Media is seeking damages in addition to seeking destruction of all of KKW Beauty's existing stock for the fragrance. This could end up being a really interesting case because apparently this new fragrance resulted in over $5 million of sales in its first 5 minutes. So it'll be interesting to watch this case. And apparently this is not the first time that Kim Kardashian has been accused of trademark infringement. A number of folks in one of her prior launches of a fragrance accused her bottle and her packaging of being very similar to a Jean-Paul Gaultier fragrance. So
it's just the cost. I mean, it's just the cost of doing business, right? I mean, you represent many high profile, you know, clients involving these issues. I mean, at some point when you're big enough, like the Kardashians, and it's a multi-billion dollar operation, you're going to have people all the time coming out of the woodwork and claiming that you're infringing on their intellectual property. But in this case, actually, it's a pretty good argument. I mean, the bubble, you know, the thought bubble is pretty close. The name's the same, you know?
It's interesting, yes. And that's why it's really important to make sure that you do what we call brand clearance in advance of a launch, especially when you're launching a product where having to do a rebrand and destroying product could result in pretty high damages to the company. So,
all right, moving on to more celebrities in hot water. I mean, we're using the term celebrity here loosely when we talk about Color Me Bad, even though I know that it's one of Tina Martini's and maybe David Sussler's famous or favorite bands from the 90s, favorite boy bands. Color Me Bad, two D's. Famous for, of course, I Want to Sex You Up.
What a great song.
And I paused there because I cannot name any other Color
I think
Me Bad
that was
song.
It.
Ashley, any other Color Me Bad song, Sam? I bet for the concert they just like do every version of I Want to Sex You Up, like an acoustic a reggae version, like a drums only version, anyway,
a rap version.
Yeah, Brian Abrams is a member of Color Me Bad.
Not to be confused with Brian Adams.
Correct. And he was arrested Sunday night in Del Lago Casino in somewhere called Tyre, New York, and charged with attempted assault in the third degree. The video that's now all over YouTube shows Abrams, who was not performing at the time, come in from stage right as they're finishing up a song, which I think was I Want to Sex You Up. And then he pushes Mark Calderon from the band, and Calderon falls to the floor.
Is that the end of the tour?
Well, I don't know.
Was it even a tour, or was it just
a one appearance,
like a one night only type of a thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I know I'm going to go to the next show though, based on this. I mean, it's a little extra surprise at the end. It's not clear what was the incident between him and Calderon, or what the future is for the band. But the video is pretty interesting, and I guarantee you the most searches that Color Me Bad's had probably, you know, since the Clinton era.
Do we know if they broke up, kind of like the Replacements broke up on stage?
I don't know, but...
And that fateful day in the early 90s?
Yeah, but the mugshot...
is very unattractive.
I don't remember anyone in Color Me Bad looking like this guy. Yeah, times are tough for Brian Abrams. Moving on to, what do we got, Rahm Emanuel legal fees, or did we...
I thought we scrapped that one.
We scrapped that one. We're moving on to another one of Tina's favorite performers, Offset.
Oh, yeah.
Do we know Offset. Who Offset is?
Barely. Tina? I've heard of Offset.
Offset was just released from jail. Offset is the husband of Cardi B, who's a rapper, very much now in the news. He was just released from jail. His real name is Kiari Kendrell Cephas. He was arrested.
Now I know why he's Offset.
Yes. Well, now you know him. Now you're much more a fan of Kiari Kendrell Cephas. He was arrested last Friday in Georgia for an improper lane change, marijuana possession, possession of a weapon by a convicted felon, and last but not least, possession of a weapon during the commission of a crime. Cardi B was all over Instagram on Saturday, and she uploaded the story posing next to Offset. She said in her Instagram post, home, and for the record, Offset is not on probation, which is contrary to what we thought, because he was arrested in 2016 for driving with a suspended license in Atlanta. He's also spent some time in jail after drug and gun charges during a concert at Georgia Southern University. So, good news for Cardi B and Offset fans. He's now out of jail. Favorite Offset song, Tina? We always like to ask that question.
There's so many great ones I can't pick.
Ashley, favorite Offset song? Nothing. Cardi B? We like the Cardi B, right? Sam loves both Offset and Cardi B. Next week when he's in studio, we'll talk about that further. All right, so moving on to a sexting scandal. This is a pretty interesting story that a lot of attention in legal circles. So William Vogue was the managing partner of a firm called Latham & Watkins, which is one of the highest grossing law firms in the world. He was earning about $6 million a year. The average partner compensation at Latham is about $3 million a year. So he was doing well at the height of his profession. He was in Chicago on a business trip back in November, and he got into a series of texts with a woman who is from Naperville. Her name is Andrea Vassell. They had never met. They had never had any relationship before. Mr. Vogue was actually allegedly texting her to deal with this other situation for a man that she was involved with. She was involved with a member of a Christian organization, a Christian business organization. He was trying to mediate a dispute between the founder of this organization, which is called the New Canaan Society, and Vassell. Anyway, one thing led to another, and the text dealing with the situation she had with this other man led to a series of texts where he was sexting her, she alleges. Well, she didn't wait very long, and she sent emails to lots of different people, including competitors of Latham, including management at Latham, including Vogue's wife. And shortly thereafter, he resigned as managing partner of Latham. She has admitted that she had a problem with sending impulsive emails. She said, "Don't you think we both could be at fault?" But fairly quickly, one of the most successful and prestigious attorneys in the country is now out of a job.
Tina? It's tough. Latham is an amazing firm, and it's unfortunate.
Yes. Got to be careful what you text. Last story here on Legal Face-Off is another intellectual property dispute, this one involving a T-shirt. Tina?
Yes. So last March, University of Illinois sued Ted O'Malley for trademark infringement. He was putting out T-shirts with the word Illinois, as well as a drawing of the school's former mascot, Chief Illiniwek, and the phrase, "Make Illinois Great Again." A settlement has been reached where the school has agreed to pay this alumni of U of I $7,500 in exchange for O'Malley agreeing to stop selling the T-shirt and to agree to cease from selling any additional T-shirts in the future. And the university has decided to dismiss its lawsuit, and they will not challenge his use of "Make Illinois Great Again." There are no real additional details on this settlement. They've declined to comment.
Yeah, we've covered all the controversy with the mascot, which, as you mentioned, was retired in 2007. I think this is just a further step towards that.
That does it for Legal Face-Off here on WGN Radio this week. Thanks to Ben Anderson. My name is Sam Panionovich. Rich and Tina back with you next time. And I'll be in studio in August in Chicago. We'll talk to you then on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know.